Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. When protests erupted around the country in late May after the police killing of George Floyd, police departments responded with violence. The Washington Post found that from May 28th to June 2nd, at least 12 people lost vision in one eye after being struck by police munitions. They were hit with beanbag rounds, pepper balls, and in one case, a gas canister. ProPublica has compiled 68 videos showing clear instances of police officers escalating violence during protests across the country. Most departments refuse to share details about investigations and discipline or even officers' names. Here are just a couple examples. On May 29th in San Jose, California, an officer shot Derek Sanderlin in the groin as he held his hands in the air. Sanderlin, who has volunteered as a police anti-bias trainer, needed surgery and was told by doctors that he might not be able to have children. The San Jose Police Department says the videos documented are part of an internal affairs investigation. And then on May 30th in Austin, Texas, police shot 16-year-old Brad Levi Ayala in the head with what they call a less lethal beanbag round. Ayala was hospitalized and underwent neurological testing following the shooting. In June, the department said it placed five officers on administrative leave. And in Portland, federal agents were shooting rubber bullets and tear gas directly into crowds. So what are the legal issues around this kind of violence? Yesterday, the administration announced they will pull federal officers out of Portland, and they're threatening to send additional agents to other cities, including Cleveland, Milwaukee, and Detroit. Joining us to give us an update on what is happening in Portland is Gregory McKelvey, Vice Chair of Oregon Democratic Black Caucus and Board President of Brown Hope. It's a community organization focusing on racial justice. Gregory wrote a piece called America, Here's the Truth About Portland's Protest That the Mainstream is Hiding. And you can read that at yourcallradio.org. Gregory was born and raised in Portland, Oregon. Hi, Gregory. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Great to have you. We're also joined by Emerson Sykes, staff attorney with the ACLU's Speech, Privacy, and Technology Project. Emerson focuses on free speech protections. Hi, Emerson. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, Rose. Thanks so much for having me.
Great to have you. Well, Gregory, I want to start off with you. In so many of the articles I'm reading, we're almost forgetting why people have taken to the streets in Portland over 60 days, which is incredible. Can you first just remind us, why are people in Portland taking to the streets for more than 60 days?
Absolutely. So just like in the rest of the country, I think our protests were spurred by the death of George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, Ahmaud Arbery. But they also remind us, as in other cities across the country, of the countless deaths that have occurred in our city. So names like Quanis Hayes or Patrick Kimmins, Jason Washington, Terrell Johnson that have been killed in Portland. And so it's not just about seeking justice for George Floyd, but also trying to remind people and receive justice for the local deaths at the hands of the police. But had there not been such a violent response to these protests, I think that they would have not continued for so many days. Each day sort of became a protest of the previous day's actions by police. So when you see things like Portland police deploying tear gas or shooting people in the head with less lethal rounds, that drives more people out into the street the next day, not just to protest for George Floyd or for the deaths that have occurred locally, but also over the heavy-handed tactics that were occurring in the protests. On top of that, we've had calls to defund the police, and this all happened in the middle of what was going to be our budget vote, and our city council decided not to heed the demands of the protesters to defund police of $50 million, and that, again, escalated tensions and kept the protests going. So that is why I believe that the protests continued for so many days.
In the piece that you wrote for Revolt, you write, the city might seem like an odd choice for such a drastic escalation in this national moment, but for those like myself who were born and raised in Portland, it makes perfect sense. My home is a deeply segregated city. To understand what's currently happening in Portland, you must first understand our tragically racist history, the 50-odd days that precipitated the invasion of Trump's armed troops, and the on-the-ground reality, both of protesters and for the rest of its residents. So you talked about what's happening on the ground. You also really dive into the history of Portland in your piece. What do you think people need to know about that history?
Yeah, I think Portland has a lack of diversity that I think is striking to many people as they visit that come from other cities. And I don't say that to erase the many Black and Indigenous and people of color that live in Portland, but that is not by accident. It was by design. Oregon was founded as what was supposed to be a white utopia. Oregon was not a slave state, but not for any moral reasons, but rather because the Oregonians did not want Black people in the state, slave or not. And so that led to a lack of diversity as people were migrating west. They were not coming to Oregon because Black people were not allowed to live there. Then when Black people finally did come, it was to be building ships for World War II, doing a lot of the work to help us win that war. And the area of town that they were living in did not have good infrastructure or support from local officials. And it ended up flooding, killing dozens of people, and displacing our entire Black community, many of which then moved back east or were scattered across the city. And then in more recent history, of course, we've had horrible gentrification of what Black neighborhoods remained that is similar to what is occurring in cities across the country.
You also write about the history of police in Portland. How have the police responded to protests before the federal agents arrived?
Yeah, we had a large wave of protests that I was also involved in after the election of Donald Trump, not specifically to protest Donald Trump, but rather to demand that our officials step up in a time that Trump would be president to protect us from his administration and to really ensure that Portland would be a sanctuary city in every sense of the word. Those protests were met with police violence time and time again, whether it be arrests, tear gas, flashbangs, intimidation, etc. But what has also occurred is we have had these alt-right invasions, sort of these mini Charlottesville events that have continued to happen in Portland as the far right sees Portland as a liberal city that they want to demonstrate in to show their ability sort of to bring freedom, I guess, to Portland. And when those protests would occur, there would be strong anti-fascist counter protests, and police would always line up with their backs to the alt-right, facing the anti-fascist protesters, and oftentimes leading to tremendous violence at the hands of the police against anti-fascists while the alt-right would be cheering on the police. And so that really raised tensions between protesters of all types and the Portland Police Bureau. It came out later that there had been, through public records requests, that there were friendly text messages between the Portland police and the alt-right groups. There was a situation in which Portland police found alt-right groups with long guns trained upon anti-fascist protesters from a parking garage, and they kept that information quiet and failed to make any arrests in that situation. And so all of that then precipitates a situation in which activists, anti-fascist, Black Lives Matter protesters have tremendous distrust of the police, and I believe that the police and our local officials view protesters as an obstacle or as an enemy rather than as a tool to push for further progress in our city.
Emerson, we'll go deeper into this in the second half of the show. But Gregory and another guest that we had on from Portland said, you know, even before the federal agents arrived, there was a lot of police violence. I mean, the ProPublica has documented this, 68 videos showing clear instances of police officers escalating violence.
Yeah, I mean, it's a really horrible situation where, you know, the images that we're seeing of unmarked and unidentified federal agents invading U.S. cities and pulling people into unmarked cars is particularly alarming. But as Gregory said, and many people know from their own experience, this is not a new situation where law enforcement officers are violating people's rights. And I think it's important to situate it both within the historical narrative in Portland, but also within the broader narrative of policing and protest in the United States. And a lot of these issues are not particularly new, though that's not to say that they're not distressing. I mean, the fact that we have someone in the White House calling on law enforcement officers to, quote, dominate protesters, I think the message is clear. Whether it's federal agents, whether it's local law enforcement, the message from the government is clear that they do not support the movement against police brutality. They do not support the movement in favor of Black lives, and they're doing everything they can to silence it.
Right. And what are your thoughts about Gregory's comment about people taking to the streets because of the federal agents coming in and federal agents escalating the violence?
Yeah, I mean, it's the height of absurdity that people who are protesting against police brutality are then met with more police brutality. And so, you know, we've been trying to push back all around the country, including our affiliate in Oregon, where we have been seeing these abuses of rights. I mean, we've been seeing excessive use of force by police officers. We've been seeing infringements on the right to protest. But, you know, the First Amendment is probably most at threat when people are face-to-face with those with whom they have their grievance. You know, I've been talking to friends about how anti-police brutality protests have a special flavor because it's different than protesting against a tax policy or an education policy. Not that those are not very important, but when you're face-to-face with the people who you're protesting against in the police, tensions do tend to run high. Though I have to say, there are thousands of protests all over the country that are happening without incident. You know, I took part in a protest with my son's elementary school, and there were, you know, hundreds of folks having their voices heard, having local impact, with no violence to be seen. I think we have to also push back on the narrative that to protest is to engage in some high-risk behavior. I mean, we have been seeing these horrible images across the country, and we've been trying to respond to them, but I want people to feel empowered and know that they do have the right to take to the streets to be heard.
Emerson Sykes is a staff attorney with the ACLU's Speech, Privacy, and Technology Project. Gregory McKelvey is vice chair of the Oregon Democratic Black Caucus and board president of Brown Hope. And I'm sorry for that loud buzz, but we're still pretty constrained with our technology due to COVID. We'll try to figure out if we can maybe improve that. If you'd like to join us, if you have any questions or comments about the police violence that we're seeing out on the streets. If you know you've been out on the streets, what has your experience been like? And we're going to talk more later about the legal issues around all of this. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Actually, Emerson, are you talking to us on a speakerphone?
I'm not.
Okay. Sorry. All right. Well, I'm just trying to figure out what that buzz is.
I can try to fix a different headphone.
Okay. That would be great. Thank you. Gregory, can you just tell us what it has been like out on the streets? Vice News' Dexter Thomas has been reporting from out on the streets, and he said, it's just so overwhelming with the tear gas. It kind of takes over your body, and you feel like you want to throw up. He said it's just really intense to be around these projectiles and the tear gas, not knowing what's coming next. Can you explain just what it's been like to be on the streets?
Yeah, absolutely. It's usually been a pretty usual routine where the protest really picks up around 9 p.m. Around 10 or 11, you start experiencing the impacts of tear gas. Very rarely do we hear any sort of warning or anything, and it's not gas the way I think people think about it, where you can see a cloud. It is certainly cloudy there, but it's not a cloud you can run from or see while you're in it or anything like that. And so there's been situations where I feel as though I have enough gear and I can help people. Usually when I'm there, I try and pull people out of the area when they can't see, or try and flush people's eyes. But your skin begins to burn incredibly badly, and if you don't have anything protecting your eyes or your lungs or your nose, you instantly are sort of immobilized. It's supposed to be something to disperse people, but you can't see at all, and so it's not a situation in which you could run away. You sort of have to just try and bear it. Hopefully some medic or somebody will come by and try and flush your eyes out. And in the midst of all this, while you can't see, you're hearing and feeling flashbangs going off around you, and then you might also be being hit with what we believe is pepper balls, or depending on what the police agency is, with rubber bullets or some sort of impact munitions. And so it does get really chaotic really quickly. If you have some sort of protective gear, you can stay around a little bit longer. But what usually happens is there are some amount of people trying to help others either get away or be able to see. It usually takes about 20 minutes before you can even see at all. Get them out of the street, as there still is oftentimes traffic trying to get through in downtown Portland. And so, yes, it is incredibly chaotic and violent in a dangerous situation. It's not something that you could bring youth or dogs or something to. It's not that sort of protest. And usually what you don't see any provocation on the side of protesters. Sometimes the fence will be shaking a little bit. You might hear a firework go off, maybe see a water bottle thrown or something like that. But I would argue that that doesn't justify indiscriminate use of force against nonviolent protesters. It's not how we deal with any other sort of crime in our society.
Gregory, a couple of days ago, you tweeted that your wife had to go to the hospital because of tear gas. What happened and how's she doing?
So she's doing better now. I think it will be a long recovery, both physically and emotionally, because the impacts of don't just last while you're there. Both of us were vomiting the next day, the last time that we had been out. And then it impacts women in a lot of different ways. And so she did have to go to the hospital. She's out of the hospital and is home and doing better. But she's in a lot of pain still. And I think that it's important that we think about the long-term effects of this tear gas. There are people that have been out there for 50 to 60 days taking tear gas from Portland police and from federal officers. And I don't know if there has been any studies on the long-term impacts of such gas. And I just pray and hope that we don't have a situation in 5, 10, 50 years where the people who have been protesting now are experiencing some form of cancer or whatever the effects of such chemical warfare might be on individuals.
Wow, that's such a good point. And Emerson, Tuck Woodstock, who's a journalist, highlights the feds in Portland, really, in their words, what appears to be engaged in targeting protesters and press alike with headshots with their riot munitions. And here's just a couple examples. Oregon Live reports Andre Miller and Daniel Anderson's 5-year-old son sobbed and backed away from his dad when he returned home from the hospital. Miller, 36, attended protests against racism and police brutality. He was hospitalized after federal police shot him in the head with a riot munition. And this is just one of many examples of what happened in Portland. What are the legal issues specifically around this, Emerson? Did we lose Emerson? Okay, I think we lost Emerson. Yeah, we're giving him a call back. What about that, Gregory? You tweeted these images. It's four people. I mean, it just looks horrific. They're laying in a hospital bed with blood coming out of their just different parts of their faces. Do we still have Gregory? Okay, I think we're having some technical issues. Well, we are still dealing with COVID, and we're all hosting the shows in different areas and working on the shows in different areas. So I think something's going on at the studio. Today, we are joined by Emerson Sykes, staff attorney with the ACLU's Speech, Privacy, and Technology Project. Gregory McKelvey is vice chair of the Oregon Democratic Black Caucus and board president of Brown Hope. And while we get them back on the phone, there's a very disturbing video that came out of the Washington Post. And we do have it on our website, yourcallradio.org, but warning, it's really difficult to watch. I'm going to play a clip for it in the second part of the show for the ACLU's Emerson to comment on. From May 28th to June 2nd, at least 12 people lost vision in one eye after being struck by police munitions. They were hit with beanbag rounds, pepper balls, and in one case, a gas canister. So we will talk about the legalities around that in the second half of the show. And I think we have our guest back. Gregory, are you back with us?
I am, yes.
Great. And Emerson, are you back?
I am.
Okay, Gregory, did you want to jump in there?
Sorry, I missed what you had just said.
Oh, okay. I thought you wanted... I just wanted to ask... well, you have to leave us in a minute. So I just wanted to ask, you tweeted a piece. The journalist Tuck Woodstock has horrific photos of people who were hit by, you know, various... I'm not even sure what these things are, but their eyes in some cases are shut. And on one woman on her forehead, it looks like she was shot in the forehead. I mean, this is just, like you said, what are the long-term effects going to be around this? And do you, based on your knowledge, is this common? I mean, right here, I see four photos.
Yeah, absolutely. It's very common. I'd say most people are trying to wear helmets. But many of my friends have been hit with their helmets on, and still have huge bruises on their heads afterwards. I assume that the impacts on the brain are definitely really bad. And so, and I also do believe that they are aiming for people's heads. I don't think that, any of these munitions should be used at protests. I think that the vast majority of people there are nonviolent protesters, and I just would compare it to the way that we police any sort of other crime. There's no other crime where officers just get to inflict pain upon people, or where they're supposed to just be able to inflict pain upon people with no warrant, no charges, nothing. They're just specifically trying to hurt people for opposing their actions.
And before we let you go, Gregory, according to reports, the feds are going to leave Portland. Is that happening?
It didn't happen yesterday. Currently, right now, local police are clearing the area. And so it may be the case, but protesters aren't going to be leaving Portland. And I'm sure that someone will be policing those protesters, whether it be our state police, the National Guard, or Portland Police, or some combination of all three. And so I think we'll still see scenes of protests from Portland. We'll still see tear gas. And while the feds' tear gas definitely hurts a little bit more, it will continue to be what I think is a civil rights violation.
Gregory McKelvey is vice chair of the Oregon Democratic Black Caucus and board president of Brown Hope. Gregory, thank you so much for joining us, and I hope that your wife is okay.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Coming up after a break, we will continue our conversation with Emerson Sykes, staff attorney with the ACLU's Speech, Privacy, and Technology Project, and we will go a little deeper and talk about the legal issues around police violence. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today, we are talking about the legal issues surrounding police violence. We're joined by Emerson Sykes, staff attorney with the ACLU's Speech, Privacy, and Technology Project. And if you have any questions or comments about this, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. The Trump administration is threatening to send federal agents to additional cities, including Cleveland, Milwaukee, and Oakland. And people in Oakland are actually organizing online. They've actually had protests to talk about how they are going to respond to all of this. So what are your thoughts about that? Emerson, what is the relationship between the state and the feds? I mean, in the case of Oregon, of course, most of the Democrats came out and said, we didn't ask you to come here. We want you to leave. What happens in a case where the politicians do want the feds to come in?
Well, what we've seen across the country is a variety of different ways in which federal agents have been used to quell protests. So in Washington, D.C., what we saw was the Department of Justice using a mechanism called special deputization, whereby they used Homeland Security officials, including Customs and Border Patrol officials, to respond to protesters, to shut down protests out in Lafayette Square so that the president could have a photo opportunity. I think we all remember that particularly disgusting episode. But what we've seen across the country is a variety of different mechanisms that the federal government has used. And it's not always clear exactly what authority they're using in order to act. So in Portland, the federal agents supposedly had a mandate just to protect federal property. They weren't there to respond to protests. They were there to protect federal property. But that left unanswered some questions around what exactly were the limits of their authority and how much they could do outside of the federal property. So we're seeing all sorts of other arrangements, including in Chicago and in Milwaukee, where the federal agents are being called in explicitly to lend a helping hand to local law enforcement in dealing with either gang activity or explicitly about protests. But sometimes they talk about defending federal property and sometimes they don't. And even my friends who are experts in this area of the law are still trying to figure out exactly what rules, if any, they're playing by.
And is it legal for the federal government to send in these forces without consent from the state?
I mean, it's an interesting legal question, but I think it kind of misses the point, right? I mean, what we're seeing is violations of the Constitution in the streets, sometimes by federal agents, sometimes local police. The mechanisms by which federal agents can engage in a local level will vary depending on the particular situation. You know, what was the authority they were acting under and how did their actions comport with that authority? And depending on whether this is a Customs and Border Patrol agent who's been, you know, seconded to by the DOJ, or if this is some other set of federal agents being used by Department of Homeland Security, I mean, it becomes, you know, DHS and the DOJ, it becomes a bit of an alphabet soup. And it's important to try to trace these lines of accountability so that we can hold folks to account for violations. But I also do want to keep our eye on the idea that whatever agency a law enforcement official is representing, the important thing is that they don't tear gas people indiscriminately, that they don't pull people into vans, unmarked vans, without any due process, that they don't try to shut down protests because there may be some unlawful activity supposedly by some people. So it's important to try to figure out what on earth the feds are doing in these places, but it's a complicated answer and it shouldn't distract us from the bigger question of how are we going to address the issues within our country that are being raised by the Black Lives Matter movement, and also how are we going to make sure that police officers respect people's constitutional rights?
Well, and Trump is constantly testing how far he can go. So, for example, this morning he tweeted, you know, delay the election until people can properly, securely, and safely vote. And with this tactic of sending in federal agents to cities across the country, I mean, it's clear it's a political ploy because, as Gregory said, we probably wouldn't have seen as many people on the streets if these federal agents hadn't shown up. So he's clearly testing how far he can go. What concerns you the most about this? What kind of precedent does this set?
Well, the message is being received loud and clear, right? The president and his administration have no interest in the kind of dialogue that the Black Lives Matter movement and the masses of people in the street are trying to push us towards. And they are actively trying to quell this moment. And I think for us, the most important thing is not just to respond. And, you know, as was the case with the president so many times, we're stuck responding to his latest provocation. And I think we need to keep our eye on, as Gregory was saying, and as you started with, why people are in the streets and how we bring about the kind of change we want to see. As I said, we're going to try to chase down these leads. We're going to try to figure out how to hold folks accountable for any abuse of discretion. There are all sorts of rules about the delegation of authority from the states to the federal government. But those sort of complicated legal arguments aside, I think that we should not let the narrative become about which kind of law enforcement officers can do what. Because that is really not the biggest part of what's going on here.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying, but when you think about activists taking to the streets, I mean, a fully militarized presence really does shift people's thinking around police and what police can do. I mean, just listening to the Vice News reporter, Dexter Thomas, he said, you know, in the first couple days, you're completely shocked by what you're seeing. These explosions happening, the tear gas taking over your body. He goes, and then on the fourth and fifth day, you stand there and you just expect it. So it's an interesting thing to think about, you know, what it does around the thinking around repressive actions from the state and the feds.
No, totally. And I think the use of tear gas, of rubber bullets, of other so-called less lethal weapons that Gregory was talking about, you know, these are counter to international human rights law. My background is in international human rights law. And according to the laws of war, these are illegal weapons. So there's no question whether you're a fed or a local law enforcement, they should not be using tear gas indiscriminately. And this is not just according to Greg McKelvey or even to me, but federal courts in Portland have found that have enjoined, meaning they've prohibited law enforcement officers from continuing to use tear gas against peaceful protesters. And despite that ruling, we've seen agents continue to do so. And I think your point about the militarization of the police is a hugely important one. And I think also it fits, though, into a broader narrative that this has been an evolution in policing over the last generation, where, you know, decommissioned military equipment has been used by local law enforcement officers. So the militarization of policing is a huge problem, but it goes far beyond any particular deployment. And just as you were saying that they're pulling some federal troops out of Portland, they're deploying them elsewhere. So the ball is continuing to move, and the tactics are shifting slightly, but the overall approach of militarization, of domination, is continuing.
And then thinking about the agents in unmarked vans pulling people, taking people off of the streets, on Tuesday, a viral video on Twitter showed a young trans woman named Nikki being taken off the streets by plainclothes NYPD officers. They put Nikki into an unmarked van. And in the video, we see protesters screaming and trying to help Nikki. But then you see NYPD officers on bikes forming kind of a circle around the van so nobody can get to Nikki. City officials, including Scott Stringer, New York City's comptroller, said he was, quote, deeply concerned. In a statement, the NYPD said the protester violated security cameras. So is this something that we're going to see in other cities across the country, Emerson? I mean, this is really frightening because if unmarked federal agents can start pulling people off the streets, what's to say that shady characters can't do the same thing and people have no idea who they are?
No, that video that you're describing was disgusting, and the conduct that it depicts
is blatantly unconstitutional. And I think it underscores the point that it's not just a matter of feds versus local. These are, I think even the unmarked vehicle might have also been NYPD. So the point is the violation of the rights. And what we saw there was blatantly unconstitutional. It is extremely dangerous for there to be a precedent that, you know, a secret police force can grab people off the street without identifying themselves, without giving people any sort of warning. There are established rules under the Fourth Amendment for how the government can take someone into custody. What is the level of evidence that they need to have? What is the proper protocols for giving people notice? And all of that appears to have been thrown out the window. And we've seen these really horrifying images of people being, you know, grabbed off the street and thrown into the back of a car. And that's just blatant kidnapping is what it is. And it shows the lawlessness in the approach of the administration, whether it be national or in some cases these police departments. Whether we're going to see it elsewhere, I sure hope not. But we have to be vigilant, and we have to continue to push back and show that this kind of conduct is unacceptable. I think, you know, another point that we can get into later is how hard it is to actually hold police accountable for their abuses. But we're doing our best. And as I said, for now, a lot of the courts are holding. Courts have ruled again and again that indiscriminate use of tear gas, rubber bullets, shutting down protests for no reason is unconstitutional. And so we're proud that the ACLU, many of our partners, many of our local affiliates have brought lots of cases all over the country, and we've won a lot of them. But what we've seen in the streets is that law enforcement officers have, in some cases, ignored those rulings, and we're now trying to figure out if we can hold those police departments in contempt of court for violating those court directives to obey the Constitution.
The Washington Post quoted a criminal law professor, Matthew Toxin, and he said that these seizures, pulling people off the streets, likely violates the Fourth Amendment, which requires officers to have probable cause before arresting a suspect. Emerson, you put together a video, kind of a Know Your Rights video. What would you say to people who might be at a protest and they or someone they know is picked up by people in unmarked vans and in plainclothes?
It's a good question. I mean, I think, you know, one of the things that we advise people is before you go out, have a plan. We have a variety of sort of practical advice about what you should do with your cell phone. But I think having a buddy, making sure that either you go out to a protest with someone or you make sure that folks know that you're going so that you can be contacted is really important. And I think it, especially if someone's going to be, you know, taken away in an unmarked car, if you have a buddy who's there and can identify you and knows where you're and knows that you've been taken, that can make a big difference. I think, you know, it's hard to provide advice for how to interact with police officers if they're ignoring all the rules that are in place. But I think the one thing that you can say is make sure you don't talk to them. You don't try to explain away the situation. You don't try to talk your way out of it, demand an attorney, and refuse to answer any questions until your attorney arrives. I mean, I think, you know, what we've seen in New York City is that, you know, people have worked hard on social media to try to figure out what and where and who what happened to Nikki and to follow up on her case. But if this happens to you, the main thing is to make sure that you don't say anything until your attorney is there.
Today, we are speaking with Emerson Sykes, staff attorney with the ACLU's Speech, Privacy, and Technology Project. What is your response to the federal agents that were in Portland and Trump's threats to send agents to other cities, including Oakland, California? What are your thoughts about the escalating violence that we're seeing on the streets? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. What questions do you have around the precedent that this sets? You can also email your call at kalw.org. Emerson, I also wanted to talk to you about a very disturbing video and investigation that was conducted by the Washington Post. The Post found that from May 28th to June 2nd, at least 12 people lost vision in one eye after being struck by police munitions. Eight of those injuries occurred on the Saturday after George Floyd was killed. These people were hit by beanbag rounds, pepper balls, and in one case, a gas canister. And I just want to play a clip from the video. In the video, you will hear from the people who lost their vision in one eye. Linda Tirado, a photojournalist, Balen Brake, a student, John Sanders, a recently laid off retail clerk, Brandon Sains, a recently laid off furniture store worker, Russell Strong, an artist, Jax Feldman, a chef, Leslie Fulcron, a student, and Sean Stearns, the manager of a dog walking company. And here is a clip from that Washington Post investigation.
May 30th, in states from California to Ohio. Six of the injured were men and two were women. They were hit with what are called less lethal weapons, beanbag rounds, pepper balls, and in one case, a gas canister.
So I squeezed my eye shut and started yelling, I'm pressed.
Well, I never thought I was going to go to a protest and lose an eye.
Whatever did just happen is catastrophic.
When he hit me, I just noticed the blood just coming out.
Something, a fire had exploded in my face.
And I turned around that corner, and then all of a sudden I was struck in the eye.
It was like I was burning up, like burning, I'm being burnt alive.
The pain, my eye was like the size of a softball at that time.
Most of the police departments and law enforcement agencies involved said the incidents are under investigation. Several said projectiles were fired because rocks or other objects had been thrown at officers. Others said it was because crowds refused to disperse. The Post interviewed witnesses and reviewed 911 calls.
He's bleeding a lot and it hit his left eye.
Police reports, cell phone, and surveillance video. In three cases where we obtained extensive images and video, those who were injured posed no obvious threat to the police. In each instance, video appears to undermine official accounts of the incident.
And that is really a shocking and incredible investigation by the Washington Post. Emerson, are you familiar with this, that 12 people lost their vision in one eye between May 28th and June 2nd?
Yeah, and I think, one of the first cases that the ACLU brought, we had our affiliate in Minnesota brought a case on behalf of a journalist, Jared Goyette, who was covering the demonstrations in Minneapolis, which, of course, is the hometown of George Floyd. It's where this all began, and he was also shot in the face with a rubber bullet, and we immediately sued as a violation of his First and Fourth Amendment rights. It was an excessive force, and we have been successful so far in that prosecution, but this is something that we've seen all over the place and that we're trying our best to push back against, but it's really horrifying.
I mean, it's really horrifying because this is just, these are the people that we know of just from May 28th to June 2nd, 12 people losing vision in one eye. And I should say five of the people we heard from are white, three are black. One of the women in the video, Leslie Fulcron, I mean, she said, I've been taking care of my mom and now my family needs to take care of me. I mean, is this legal? Hitting people with beanbag rounds, pepper balls, a gas canister in their eyes? I mean, what can be done about this?
Absolutely not. It is totally unconstitutional. It is totally illegal. The kinds of things that you heard in that report are, the police saying, they failed to respond to a dispersal order. Or they had been engaging in, you mentioned that Nikki in New York had been engaged in some kind of allegedly property destruction. And I think what we've seen is that these very minor issues, especially failing to respond to a dispersal order, we've seen all kinds of abuses in terms of dispersal orders. What law enforcement is required to do, their primary responsibility is to protect the rights of people in their communities, right? So that is including the protecting the right to protest. So where there is a threat of violence, it's the police obligation to de-escalate that threat and to isolate and respond to any unlawful activity in a proportionate way. What we've seen instead is time and time again, officers all over the country escalating conflicts and using minor violations like stepping in the street or failing to comply with an officer's orders as a pretext for totally disproportionate use of force. And we think that, you know, especially this idea of failure to comply with orders, where so many of these police orders have been improper, have been unconstitutional, the idea that failing to quickly do exactly as an officer said is then pretext for all sorts of abuses, I think is really concerning. And I think the idea that someone engaging in some level of property destruction then sort of means that an entire protest needs to be shut down or that massive numbers of people need to be arrested, I think is also misguided as well. So we have to think about these things in a more nuanced way. It's not there are good protests and bad protests or peaceful protests and violent protests, but really the obligation of law enforcement is to do their job. And as Gregory said, you know, in the normal course of investigation, you figure out what's going wrong, you identify the people you think who are doing it, and you respond in a proportionate way without impacting other folks. And by definition, the use of tear gas and the use of rubber bullets and those types of projectiles is indiscriminate and therefore unconstitutional and unlawful.
How does video evidence change any of this? Because in the case of the Washington Post, they have video evidence of what happened on the streets. They also interviewed all of these people who lost vision in one eye. It's just shocking. In the case of ProPublica, they reviewed over 400 videos on social media. 49 of those videos showed pepper spray and tear gas were used inappropriately. In 87 videos, officers punched, pushed, and kicked protesters. And then, as I read in the intro, I mean, in some cases, people actually got shot. In the case of Derek Sanderlin, he was shot in the groin, and doctors say that he might not be able to have children again. He's newly married.
Yeah, I think the role of video has been clear, right? With George Floyd's death itself was video recorded. Same with Ahmaud Arbery. And we've seen how important video evidence can be in terms of directing national dialogue. Many people would not believe these things were happening if not for the video evidence. And same with the crackdown on protesters, as you mentioned. The tear gas, the over-militarization, people who are not in the streets would scarcely be able to believe that that's really what's happening without the video evidence. So I think it's important to highlight here that the right to record is protected by the First Amendment. So the important work, not only of journalists, but of everybody who has their cell phone that's documenting these police interactions, and also, you know, documenting all of the protests that are totally empowering and peaceful and go very well. It's important to also document those and share those stories. But I think the right to record is a really important one because it's been so crucial in this movement gathering momentum. So it's important to say that, you know, police can ask you to step away if you're, quote, interfering with legitimate police activity, but recording from a safe distance is totally protected by the First Amendment and can be vitally important to spreading the message and to holding folks accountable afterwards. You know, if you do witness something that's unlawful or unconstitutional, having video evidence of that can go a long way towards holding those folks accountable, though there are, you know, institutional ways in which the police are protected, but you can overcome those with proper evidence.
Well, we've got a couple calls. Let's see if we can take two quickly, and then we'll get a response. We are almost out of time. Let's hear from Robert in Richmond. Hi, Robert. Do we have Robert? Nope. All right, let's go to Phyllis in Menlo Park. Hi, Phyllis. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you for taking calls. My first is about the first question, but the second one is probably more important. But quickly, what does anyone know what happens to the people that are picked up in these unmarked vans? Where do they release them? And has anyone talked to them and said who on earth were these people? And let me ask the second one before we even talk about that. I'm very worried about what you reported that Trump said today about maybe we have to delay the election. I think that's what this whole thing is about. Mm. And did you know that's what Hitler did? He was elected once and then never held another, said, oh, there's too much trouble, you know, we never held another election.
Well, thank you for calling, Phyllis. We are almost out of time. First off, Emerson, have you been able to track what has happened to people who have been picked up in unmarked vans?
I haven't personally spoken to any of those folks. As I understand it, there have been a variety of experiences, ranging from being driven a few blocks and identified as potentially the wrong person and then released. Some people have been booked and charged. But the problem, as you point out, is the lack of transparency. We don't know who these people are. We don't know what authority they're acting under. And often we don't know what exactly is happening to folks. There were hours where no one knew where they had taken Nikki, the transgender woman in New York. And so the problem of the opacity and the lack of transparency is really deep, and it makes it really hard to figure out exactly what's going on, but we know that they're trying to hide something.
And any comments, Emerson? Again, Trump's tweet, he's basically saying that mail-in voting will be inaccurate and fraudulent. There is no evidence around that. And he's saying delay the election until people can properly, securely, and safely vote.
Yeah, I mean, voting rights, my colleagues are you know, working hard on responding to trying to protect the right to vote across the country. I mean, Trump does not have the authority to delay the election. But I think this is just another in a long string of provocations. He'll see if he can get away with it. He initially tried to bring in the U.S. Army to quell protesters, and the Army pushed back. And so he decided to go with other federal agents. I think this is another example of the president seeing what he can get away with. And it's up to us to respond and let him know that he can't.
Well, thank you for the call, Phyllis. And thank you so much for joining us, Emerson. Emerson Sykes is a staff attorney with the ACLU's Speech, Privacy, and Technology Project. Thank you, Emerson.
Thanks so much, Rose. It was a pleasure.
Thank you. And you can find more information about the legal issues surrounding police violence. And again, the Washington Post video is disturbing to watch, but it really does need to be seen by people just to, you know, really elevate the voices of these 12 people who lost vision in one eye. And you can find that at yourcallradio.org. Thanks to Leah Cesarine for producing today's show. Thanks to Kevin Vance and Damian Miner for keeping our studio going. Coming up on the Media Roundtable tomorrow, we'll discuss 1,000 Cuts. It's a documentary about journalist Maria Ressa and her fight for press freedom in the Philippines, where she faces arrest by the Duterte government. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.